Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jacob Kanzler. Our special guest this week, Mackenzie Frost from Sinclair Broadcasting. Thanks for coming over, Mackenzie.
Thanks for having me, Kyle. It's good to be here.
Good to see you again. And our old friend Patrick Anderson, CEO of Anderson Economic Group. Thanks for coming over, Patrick.
Nice to be here today. Actually, nice to be anywhere where people are gathering in this hard time.
There's only four of us here, and Jacob and I are a convenient, 3 feet away? Is that
about? Yeah, well, when you put your stuff in this chair between us, I just assumed that was my cue to... yeah.
Social distancing.
Now, Mackenzie brought the hand sanitizer.
And
This is candy apple. It smells like something that a strawberry shortcake doll should be emitting.
Well, whatever it takes to keep the COVID-19 away.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'm not going to question that. And then I think we're all under 60, aren't we? All right. At least we know 3/4 of us are. All right. We won't go into more with that with Patrick. That might be the toughest question you get today. One thing we can say about Patrick, he's the only one in this room who has gone through the U.S. House bill that was passed and is on its way to the Senate that it's supposed to address this coronavirus outbreak. And it sounds like there's other things in there, too, Patrick. Why don't you explain to our listeners what's in this thing?
This is the late night. It actually passed a little before 1 a.m. on Saturday, Bill, H.R. 6201, that the president himself tweeted by bill number. You know how carefully he reads the bill numbers, that he was in favor of it, wanted it on his desk as soon as possible. And in fact, it passed on a single roll call vote with no bill analysis, no budget analysis ready. There was like a very brief, like two sentences of what was in this bill. It seems pretty clear that people did not read this, including the folks who voted on it. I spent a good chunk of Saturday because it's going over this because it is, it is potentially the biggest labor law change since the adoption of the ACA, you know, commonly called Obamacare. It's a huge bill, 10 different titles in it, and I focused on just two of them. The one that people are commonly talked about is paid sick leave and emergency sick leave, which is something that's very important to think about during the current crisis.
What did you find out about paid sick leave? Because obviously people are concerned, particularly with bars and restaurants closing, we're going to have a lot of wait staff and they're going to want some paid sick time.
Exactly. One of the things that I pointed out in here is the entire bill is about these two elements, are about sick leave, sick time. There's two separate public acts about sick time. One of them has a tremendously expansive definition of sick time. You clearly do not need to be sick, nor does a member of your family necessarily need to be sick in order to take this, and your employer must pay for it. But it is all about somebody, some way, having some kind of a sick problem or a school-related closure or something, a victimization, where you could argue there's a real need for the person to take off work. The biggest problem we have right now in Michigan across the country is actually not people who are sick. It is the people who are out of work and about to go out of work. And by problem here, I don't mean the health problem, the biggest economic problem. Obviously, if somebody's sick, that's a very serious problem to them and should be to us as a country. But in terms of the economic damage, which this is intended to address, the biggest number of people out there that are in trouble are the people who are losing hours, losing jobs, can't work, their events were canceled. And this is something that's not addressed by these bills at all.
Now, so what you're saying is that Congress is using this crisis right now to pass a Trojan horse of labor law changes that they probably wouldn't get through to the president any other way.
I didn't use the word Trojan horse, but clearly, as was evidenced by the intense debate here between the discussion, between negotiation, which apparently occurred between Secretary of Treasury and the Speaker of the House, the paid sick leave longtime objective of Democrats was included, and so was this emergency leave, which was an objective of the Republicans. The emergency leave is clearly related to the current economic crisis, where it's short term, it's in the next 2 years, and we allow nearly anybody to take it, so even self-employed persons. That part does, in fact, address some of the economic problems that we're going to have right now. The other part, the paid sick time, this is unlimited and it goes on, you know, indefinitely. It applies to nearly every employer in the country. It requires them to offer an extremely expansive policy. And it would, as far as I can read it, actually outlaw a lot of the more generous leave policies that private employers have today. So it's a huge bill. It clearly hadn't been through the kind of scrutiny that this deserves. It would cover nearly every employer. I mean, literally, you employ one person, you're under this bill. So that's a very serious issue for people to look at the next few days.
I know. I remember when it was going through Friday night, Congressman Justin Amash was tweeting about how he didn't feel like he had any time to read it, and that's why he voted present on it, because he didn't read it, and he knew that no one else read it, and he said he didn't feel like it was appropriate to vote when you didn't have time to go through it. And I thought that was interesting.
How many pages is this thing, Patrick?
I mean, I read two of the 10 titles in there, mm-hmm. Mini Acts. And I had to go through probably 80 or 90 pages of that. And there were 80% of the things were there. For example, the list of conditions that would trigger paid leave went on for, I think, 3 pages.
And you're an economic mind, and I think that's important to point out, too. I mean, you get this kind of stuff. People at home don't get this. They're not going to sit home and read this. The lawmakers aren't even going to read this.
Apparently they didn't, and I'll just give Justin Amash credit for being, you know, the honest person in the room. There's no way that somebody went through this, and passing it after midnight with no budget assessment, mm-hmm. suspension of the rules so there's no debate, it is really very risky.
Patrick, on some of the paid sick leave provisions that you are saying are expanding this, did you get a sense in reading this that any of these were kind of enacted on a temporary basis? I know that's a question that a lot of people have with a lot of some of these emergency measures. Did you get a sense from the language that this stuff is intended as temporary, or was that kind of left unanswered?
There was an answer, but it was just two answers. So there's actually the Emergency Paid Leave Act of 2020, which is temporary, 2 years. And that, if you read it, it's if you're sick or someone in your family is sick. Okay? So, and that actually has some potential for covering small businesses, covering employees, covering self-employment earnings. So there's, that one is focused on temporary and crisis. But there's also what's called the Paid Sick Time for Personal and Family Care Act. And I would really emphasize the Personal Care Act, because that's the one with the 3 pages of potential reasons to give paid sick time. And not just for you, not just for your immediate family, but also for people that are referred to in the act as people for whom you have an affinity equivalent to family. So an AEF. So think about this. If this becomes law, the AEF will replace the BFF. Because if you're an AEF, that means employers will have to pay sick time for somebody to come in, take you to a school meeting, for example, take care if you're sick, take you to a lawyer's office, lots of other things.
So I'm thinking of the paid sick leave proposal that was circulated for the ballot in 2018. What I'm hearing from you, this sounds like this is much more expansive than even that ballot proposal would have been.
Absolutely. What's in this bill, which was, again, hastily passed, no bill analysis, suspension of the rules, no debate, no hearings, after midnight, is far more expansive than anything I think people can have considered. And that's part of the reason that we spent some time on it over the weekend, because the president's already said that he wants this bill, named it. On his desk, wants to sign it. Clearly, there's a grand political agreement here that the Democrats in the House are getting a long-term objective, which was paid sick leave, which is, I think, people normally thought of it in the way that you think of paid sick leave, meaning for when you're sick. And the president and the Republicans obviously want something to stimulate the economy. So it looks like basically everything got thrown into the kitchen sink, and it got past the House after midnight.
We're looking at the economy right now. I mean, closing bars and restaurants, this is a big, Michigan isn't, we're behind the ball, I guess, now compared to the Ohio and Illinois yesterday. What do you think the long-term impacts, you know, will be? We have St. Patrick's Day. Obviously, that's a big moneymaker for some of these institutions, but how big of an impact long term could we see this?
All right, let me just deal with the short term because that's where we are this year. I mean, this is a body blow to the economy, mm-hmm. and there's no way to avoid when you're doing these kind of things to have a contraction in the economy. And I think you're basically looking at the next 45 days as like a one-month depression, not even just a recession. But when you take this number of people and you say, you're out of work, mm-hmm. You can't go to work, and you tell customers you can't go to their place of business, and a lot of them are also getting these things. I mean, it's a very, very serious effect on people's income and their well-being. Now, of course, and I'll again repeat what I said earlier, we do have public health as a priority here, and we're primarily focusing on the economic impact. Obviously, the health is more important for people. I understand periodically in history there's a need to take these kind of quarantine-type measures, and I'm not an expert on that, but we do have to take into account that we are taking well over 1 million Michigan citizens who are working, and their families rely on them, and they're telling them, don't come to work, mm-hmm. Or you customers can't serve you. That's going to have a very, very serious effect on the entire society, certainly on earnings. It's going to affect politics, culture, and health as well altogether.
Isn't the government at some point going to feel responsible, since they were the ones who issued these directives like the bars and restaurants? Are they going to have some responsibility for trying to make these businesses and vis-a-vis the employees whole, if you will, mm-hmm. to make up for the lost wages, to make up for the lost income?
This is a very good question. In Italy, we actually have a contractor, Anderson Economic Group has, in Italy, in Milan, who I've been talking with the last couple of weeks. And the Italian government has been very aggressive in terms of rolling out things to try to help people sustain their income. In this particular situation, neither the United States government nor the state of Michigan government, nor as far as I know, Illinois or other states, has done much to help people's income. And when you tell people you can't go to a restaurant, and by the way, you can't go to a sports event, and by the way, you can't gather, of the most doubtful enforceability, you can't go to church, I mean, you are affecting people's lives and livelihood. And part of their health, I will say here again, it's most important to think about their health, but they do need to support their families. The situation that you're putting a lot of people in is really untenable.
Do you think the state has the infrastructure in place to handle an influx of unemployment applications if the state were to start accepting these people?
That's a very good question, but I mean, infrastructure again, I mean, probably you can accept applications, although the state so totally botched this in the past with mm-hmm. their artificial intelligence software that declared people to be criminals. These people aren't unemployed in the normal sense, that they're looking for a job and they can't find one. These are people who were told not to come to work. And that's a serious issue, and I certainly don't want to be, I would not want to tell those people, oh, by the way, you're unemployed, go file for unemployment and fill out the same form, the one that would technically render you ineligible. So at the federal level and at the state level, if we're telling people you can't work, I think we need to do something about that.
The governor's ability to issue the orders that she has traces back to an emergency orders power given to her by the legislature back in the 1940s, 1950s. Have you gone through that, and do you see a situation where you'll see businesses push back on her ability to do what she has, or maybe even churches and her ability to say to people who congregate for religious purposes, can you really do what you're doing and telling us we can't have more than 250 people in?
I have read the Michigan Constitution multiple times, including the 08 Constitution, which would have been around in the 1940s. And clearly, the government does not have the power to tell churches what to do and doesn't have the power to tell people how to worship. Whether they have emergency powers to limit assemblies at commercial establishments in time of the public health crisis, I don't know enough about that. I do think that there's a risk if you were to follow this along that you end up with, well, we're not going to allow gatherings at all, especially those ones that are critical of us. I haven't said that Governor Whitmer's trying to do that or any politician in the United States is, but that's one of the reasons why we have a Bill of Rights, is so that the citizens' right to assemble and other things isn't infringed, and why people can, in fact, conduct private business. And I think there are questions about this, about the ability to enforce some of these restrictions. Although, at least in the short term, during a public emergency, for events that are clearly regulated under state laws, and I'll say in some cases restaurants and bars and large, commercial gatherings, I think the government does have a lot of emergency powers.
And it may be too early to even question it right now, because I think there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of uncertainty, and folks certainly don't want to be unwittingly spreading this coronavirus. And so I'm sure you're not going to get that immediate pushback. And then the people who would be pushed back, like let's say Representative Beau LaFave, would get shamed over it, because nobody has the stomach for that right now. I mean, we should be doing the right thing. And to suggest that you don't do the right thing isn't cool.
Right. To suggest that you don't do the right thing isn't cool. But I mean, churches are, of course, concerned about their own congregants. And they clearly have the power and have exercised it without waiting for the government to tell them what to do. And that's the one sector where I think the government doesn't have the power to tell the churches what to do. And the congregants there. I think there's a lot of issues, for example, about private schools. We went through what I think is a shameful chapter, where we've tried to actually prevent the use of any public money to vaccinate children who attend private schools. And yet we then went and told private schools they have to close. I think this really raises some obvious questions of not only hypocrisy, but do we really care about these children? Obviously we do. Yet we have a number of school districts, and we have actions to try to prevent any public money to be spent on vaccinating and health and safety for kids in private schools. And I think this is something that's, this particular episode really highlights how bad that action was.
Anything else that is important for us to know, Patrick?
One of the things I think that Michigan leaders need to think about, business leaders and civic leaders, is just the scale that we're talking about in Michigan. And since we did some assessment here, we're looking at somewhere between 800,000 and 1.3 million Michigan workers taking sick leave over the next 45 days of more than 2 days. Many of them are going to be taking 14 days or more. This is really a sudden change without any precedent that I can think of. And depending on what happens with the federal law and what happens at states, some or none or some share of these people receive some benefits, and some of their businesses will receive benefits. And in many cases, the employers are going to be put in a situation where they're going to either pay it because they want to, mm-hmm. or they're going to be pushed to do it. And this is going to cause extreme disruption for a lot of businesses, especially the small ones.
There are businesses that will go out of business because of the coronavirus.
There's no way you can tell bars that they have to close and you don't end up with people losing their job and some of them closing. And there's no way that you cancel all these sporting events and you don't affect people who are vendors related to that. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm not worried about the NBA players who are making millions of dollars, but I am worried about the people that are, selling programs and cleaning the arenas and stuff like that. They don't have any shoe contract with Nike. I'm not worried about Apple closing its stores and not being able to sell for a while, but I do worry about some of the people that work there.
Okay, we're going to turn the page here for a minute and talk about the state legislature. The state legislature is scheduled to come in to session on Tuesday, and we've already gotten the House agenda. The Senate one's coming soon afterwards. And there's several items on the agenda. And Mackenzie, you pointed out that the CDC has already recommended that we cancel gatherings of more than 50 people.
Yeah, that came out, yesterday, I think, or 2 days ago, over the weekend sometime. 50 people is now the new limit. And last time I checked, there are more than 50 people in the House.
Yeah, and probably more than 50 in the Senate, too, once you include staff.
And staffers. And so combined, that is well over. We're even pushing 250 at that point.
So taking a look at the legislative session, so why are they coming back? And from what I can understand, there are three big reasons why they're coming back. The first one has to do with the supplemental bill that has spending in it for the coronavirus. There is one bill that was held back and was kept there. This is Senate Bill 373, just in case additional money needed to be spent. And also, if they wanted to open up $15 million that they had already previously set aside for the coronavirus to be used immediately. The bill that has already passed both chambers, Senate Bill 151, has this $15 million in a pot that can only be spent with legislative concurrence. And I think the thought is that it sounded good at the time, but the governor may want to have the authority to spend that $15 million without legislative authority in the case that the legislature is not able to come back. So that's one thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
The second thing is, talking about appropriations, is that this canceling session from now until spring break is going to be a massive disruption on the appropriations process in general, in that by spring break, in most cases, we have the appropriations process already half done. We've already had half the bills passed by one chamber and the other half passed by the other chamber, and then they do the swap. And then when they come back, then they take them up. Now, what happens if they can't come back? Well, now they're not going to be able to move forward with the bills that they need. And as part of this last budget agreement, they are required by law, Mackenzie,
July 1st, to
have the budget done by July 1st.
The timeline is not working in their favor right now. To be fair, I don't think anybody could have pictured or planned for a global pandemic, but canceling session now wouldn't be great for getting that done.
Yeah, I was thinking too about the budget process. Obviously, Senator Shirky talked about having session when necessary. Mm-hmm. If you think about it, though, a lot of the budget doing, if you will, is done kind of honestly behind closed doors. I mean, you get a you get the committee's recommendation, it pops out during committee. A committee, you know, is a few dozen people and they pass it. So I think definitely they can still kind of move forward with the budget. But of course, the large gathering situation is always going to prevent a challenge for the larger session, but that's a little further down the road for the budget.
One other thing about session and why they're having it, there's a technical reason as well. As part of the supplemental spending bill, the legislature set aside money for this Michigan Reconnect program. And the Michigan Reconnect program is Governor Whitmer's plan to pay last dollar tuition for 25-year-olds and older who are going through 2 years of community college or going through a skilled training certificate. The problem is that this program does not exist in law right now. So if they pass the supplemental that included funding for this program, it would have nowhere to go because the program doesn't exist. So they have to create the program, and that's why they have to meet so they can pass the bills needed to get them to the governor so she can sign the bills, create the program, and then she can fund those new programs.
Sounds like a mess, honestly. I mean, really, that I understand the legislative process behind all of that, and I get why, you know, that's happening right now. I just think there's a lot of things happening, and that being one of them is just another wrinkle in this big issue right now. Thinking about closing or canceling session, though, too, you know, I know the conversation happening in Washington is, well, can they vote virtually? Mm-hmm. Could they have a virtual session? Is that something we need to look at? I don't know what infrastructure or how that would even play out. But if things need to keep moving, canceling session would really slow down a lot of these things from moving forward.
Patrick, since you've been involved in the budget process before as a deputy budget director, watching what has to happen with the appropriations process, how much time do they have to spend in session to actually get a budget passed for the next fiscal year?
They actually don't have to spend much time in session, but they do have to do it. And by the way, the legislature's number one job is to pass a budget. Now, the governor has to propose one, but if that's done properly, then I think you can get a lot done in a fairly short order if you're ready and you do your job.
All right, one other subject that I wanted to talk about. Mackenzie, how many times have you heard that the media is responsible for creating the panic surrounding the coronavirus?
All the time. all the time, especially on my social media pages. And it's getting really frustrating and it's getting really exhausting trying to combat that.
You know what I think of? I think of like this, like an old skit of somebody say, like screaming, "Why are you panicking?
Yes.
Why are you panicking? I'm not panicking. Quit panicking."
Yes. And like, and I get it. I get why people are frustrated. I get why people are scared. People are afraid of what they don't know. And we don't know a lot of things about this right now. But I do know that especially your local media continues to work tirelessly to make sure that people have the most up-to-date information. So taking out their frustrations on us is counterproductive.
I mean, we didn't cancel anything. Right? I mean, it's not like, you know, one of my favorite takes that I've seen is that the media actually likes this. Media doesn't like this.
I don't like this. I can tell you right now, I don't like this. We are changing so many things in newsrooms and policies to make sure that we stay safe so that we can still come to work and make sure that things are getting covered. Because think about it. If people at home don't have the media to tell them what's happening, where are they going to get their accurate information from?
Well, not only that, I mean, who likes to work all the extra hours, too? I mean, we're working a ton of extra hours here. We're all working weekends. The addition at MERS has been going out 10, 11 o'clock at night lately. Mm-hmm.
It's exhausting. I mean, the governor held a press conference at 11 o'clock Thursday night, you know?
11 o'clock p.m.
Yes, 11 p.m. Thursday.
And then the most recent alert as to how many cases of coronavirus came out right around 11 o'clock last night, right. Sunday night, too.
I mean, I was in bed and I just, you know, constantly refresh my email. It's an influx of information for us trying to process that and get it out for everyone. So it's as stressful, I feel like, for the people covering it as it is for the people consuming the news.
And not to say that our job is any harder than the people who are in public office right now or the health professionals or whatever, but just keep in mind that our job isn't easy either.
Yeah.
Patrick, what's been your observations from this?
I wrote last week thinking about Wednesday and Thursday alone, that this was the single biggest two-day collective investor politician panic I'd ever witnessed. And if you were an American citizen and you were looking at a cascade of closures, you know, canceling March Madness, NCAA tournament, a total meltdown in the stock market, biggest one-day drop, you know, all of a sudden we're going to close travel, and then a cascade of somewhat confusing and different statements about what we were doing. I can't blame Americans for being afraid, and I think their elected officials have, and I'm not limiting this to just one elected official or even just one state, but their elected officials and the investors, I think, have really not done a very good job on this. I'll also say that from our point of view, Anderson Economic Group's first analysis on this was February the 4th. Mm-hmm. Okay, it seems like decades ago. It was a month and a half ago. Yeah. We had four separate releases in February saying, this is serious, it's going to be an issue. Mm-hmm. I actually had to argue with reporters saying, because they were concerned I was exaggerating, and I finally wrote, this is a crisis, not a slowdown. That was in February. I'm wondering why we're panicking among politicians and stuff in the middle of March.
I think that's interesting, too, because we have known about this since, I mean, it's called COVID-19 for a reason. This came out in 2019.
I guess I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Again, our first release on this, February the 4th.
Right. And so it's been around. I mean, China has been dealing with this for months. And so we've known this, and we've known that it's been coming. It was a matter of time whether when it got here, but it's here now, and I understand the panic, and I understand why everyone is so afraid, but I also don't think that taking your frustrations out and not believing it is the right answer, because it's definitely something that you need to believe, because it's here.
All right, Patrick Anderson from the Anderson Economic Group, thanks for coming over. Appreciate it.
All right.
Mackenzie Frost from Sinclair Broadcasting from coming in as well. So what's your day looking like after this now?
This is insane. I'm not even sure. I might have to go to downstate to do another press conference, or we're working by ourselves now, so I am...
So you got to carry the camera now, too.
I'm a one-man band.
So how do you set up the camera and then get on the stool?
Well, watch at noon and we'll see how it looks.
All right. Should be interesting. Thanks also to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. For Jacob Kanzler, I'm Kyle Malin. Till next week, take care.